Hamas. This was their view of who was protesting in Egypt. Terrorists. But that is not what the rest of us could see with our own eyes. The protesters weren't just Islamists. They were secular activists, young people, Coptic Christians. Obama sensed this too. He called me up to the Oval Office. I stood in front of his desk and we discussed the administration's current public line on Egypt. "You're in all of these meetings, right?" he asked. "Yes," I said, realizing he had little idea how I spent my days when I wasn't with him. "I want you to speak up," he said. "Don't hold back just because it's the principles. You know where I'm coming from. And we're younger." I took that as license to raise my voice. Gone were the days of the Afghan review when I'd hold back my views for fear of overstepping some boundary. In one meeting, where there was broad agreement at a senior level that we should invite the leaders of key Arab countries to Washington as soon as possible to reassure them of our support, I couldn't contain myself. "Maybe if we're going to have all the corrupt autocrats over, we could think about actually inviting some of these young people too, for balance." The people at the table sat there grimly. The young people on the back bench loved it. I was inspired by the moment. I was also making enemies. Things came to a head in the Situation Room on February 1st, in a meeting where the principals were debating whether we should counsel Mubarak to step aside. Obama took the unusual step of coming down to join a meeting he wasn't scheduled to attend. We'd gone around and around, with Clinton, Gates, and others recommending that we stand by Mubarak, and the more junior people urging that we press him harder. Shortly after Obama came downstairs, Mubarak went on television to address the Egyptian people. We stopped the meeting and turned on the televisions that lined the walls. We all sat there in silence, watching Mubarak standing at a lectern, an Egyptian flag beside him, a man who had held office since 1981, just 4 years after I was born. Occasionally, I looked at Obama, but he betrayed no emotion. Mubarak announced that he would not seek another term as president. But he was combative in pledging to serve out his existing term, warning of a choice between chaos and stability, and pledging to die on Egyptian soil. When the speech was over, Obama spoke. "That's not going to cut it," he said. "Those people are not going to go home." He effectively ended the debate by saying that he was going to call Mubarak and tell him that it was his judgment that he needed to step down. The call was set up for an hour later. Staff left to go draft Obama's talking points. I went to my office to draft a statement that he would give afterward. Then I ran up to the Oval Office for the call. "I want to share my honest assessment about what I think will accomplish your goals," Obama told Mubarak. A few of us stood there, scattered across the office, farther away from the desk than normal, as if we didn't want to crowd him. Obama cradled the phone against his ear while a speaker played for the benefit of the others in the room. A translator turned Obama's words into Arabic, creating pregnant pauses and giving Mubarak extra time to digest the words, since he spoke English quite well. "I say this with greatest respect," Obama continued. "I'm extraordinarily proud of my friendship with you. It is my belief that if the transition process drags out for several months and you continue in your office, that the protests will continue. It will make the situation harder to control, and I think your role and the role of the army will be made much more difficult. I think now is the time to present Egypt to its next government. I think now it is time for you to move in a timely fashion in not allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to take advantage of the situation." "You don't understand the culture of the Egyptian people," Mubarak shot back. He had stopped waiting for translation at certain points. "Egypt is not Tunisia," he said. "These protests will be over soon." The conversation went on like that, back and forth, for another 10 minutes. I stood next to Donilon and McDonough, who leaned over and asked when was the last time that an American president had had a conversation like this with a foreign leader. "Marcos, I think," Donilon offered, speaking of Reagan's break with our ally in the Philippines. Obama began to wrap up the conversation, speaking off the cuff, no longer even glancing at the talking points. "Mr. President," he said, leaning forward, elbow on his desk. I always respect my elders. You've been in politics for a very long time. There are moments in history. Just because things have been the same way in the past doesn't mean they will be the same way in the future. When he hung up, Obama looked at us and shrugged, as if to signal that he didn't think he'd gotten through. It was the last time they spoke. During the call, there had been some churn about the statement. The key line read, "It is my belief that an orderly transition must be meaningful, it must be peaceful, and it must begin now." After the draft was circulated, calls and emails were lobbed in to Donilon and McDonough to take out the line altogether, with Gates and Clinton insisting that we at least take out, "It must begin now." As Obama was about to walk out to deliver his remarks, I asked him what he wanted to do. "Leave it in," he said. The following day, when Gibbs was asked what Obama had meant by now, he replied, "Now started yesterday." On February 5th, Obama got a call from David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who was worried that we weren't being aggressive enough in pressing Mubarak to step down. Cameron said he was confused by what Frank Wisner had said that day. "Wisner?" Obama replied. "I have not seen that." Frank Wisner came from one of the families that defined America's role in the world after World War II. His father had been one of the top people at the CIA. Wisner had had a long career at the State Department, serving as ambassador 4 times, including 5 years in Egypt at the end of the Cold War. As the protests picked up, Obama accepted a recommendation from Hillary to send Wisner to Cairo as a special envoy. He was someone whom Mubarak trusted, a reminder of a better time when our countries were in lockstep during the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Wisner's difficult task was to counsel Mubarak to initiate a transition in Egypt. The last words I heard Obama say to him as he set out on his mission were straightforward. "Be bold." Wisner succeeded in securing Mubarak's promise not to seek another term as president, but that wasn't enough for the people in the streets, or for Obama. A few days after Obama's statement calling for a transition, unbeknownst to any of us in the White House, Wisner video-conferenced into an international security conference in Munich. Because he had just completed a stint as a presidential envoy, people assumed he was speaking for the administration when he said, "You need to get a national consensus around the preconditions of the next step forward, and the president must stay in office in order to steer those changes through." This was the remark that had caught Cameron's attention. Clinton, who also attended the conference, had made comments that seemed to reinforce Wisner's. Obama was incredulous when he hung up the phone with Cameron, and he called a group of us into the Oval Office. "What is going on here?" He asked me to call the people traveling with Clinton while he called her himself. Later, after the call, Donilon told me he'd never seen him that upset, voice raised, standing at his desk. He'd already taken the unprecedented step of telling Mubarak he needed to step aside, something that was going to hurt his relationships with some powerful interests in the Gulf and Israel. Now, his own administration appeared to be walking that back. There were other voices of caution. Brennan had spent much of his career working on issues related to the Middle East. Unlike some of the other principals, he knew Mubarak couldn't weather the storm. But he warned that Egypt wasn't ready for democracy, that the population had no experience of a politics that wasn't zero-sum. The same Saturday, as I was working to clarify Wisner's statement in the press, Brennan gave me a note. "It is a truism to say that there is a far greater unity among the masses in Egypt on what and who they want to see gone than there is on what and who they want in its, their place." The next several days felt like an inevitable conclusion to a drama whose main acts had already taken place. Nothing that Mubarak said mollified the protesters, and the Egyptian military began to distance itself from him. Our media, focused on the Washington angle, was filled with stories of mixed messages coming out of the U.S. government, a dynamic that ensured we were making everyone unhappy. The people in the streets, who thought Obama had been slow and uncertain, and the people in power, in Cairo and the Gulf, who thought that Obama betrayed an ally, a belief shared by many in Washington. I was increasingly frustrated. The president I worked for had taken a bold step to embrace a social movement that was demanding change, and yet the ambivalence within his administration was going to ensure that he was seen as behind the curve. Meanwhile, I heard that the ambassadors from Saudi Arabia and the UAE, two of the most powerful envoys in Washington, were telling people in the press and the foreign policy establishment that Obama had been badly advised by younger people like me who were more interested in preserving Obama's brand than listening to the wise hands who understood that democracy couldn't work in the Middle East. It was the beginning of a multi-year effort by those two countries to restore a dictatorship in Egypt, and it would ultimately succeed. The one thing that seemed to be on our side, however, was the reality on the streets of Egypt. Day after day, the protests spread, and Mubarak's regime seemed to crumble around him. On February 11th, I woke to the news that Mubarak had fled to the resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh and resigned. It was, it seemed, a happy ending. Jubilant crowds celebrated in the streets of Cairo. I drafted a statement for Obama that drew comparisons between what had just taken place and some of the iconic movements of the past several decades. Germans tearing down a wall, Indonesians upending a dictatorship, Indians marching nonviolently for independence. I went up to the Oval Office that morning to review the statement with Obama. "You should feel good about this," he said. "I do," I replied, "though I'm not sure all of the principals do." "You know," he said, "one of the things that made it easier for me is that I didn't really know Mubarak." He mentioned that George H.W. Bush had called Mubarak at the height of the protests to express his support. "But it's not just Bush. The Clintons, Gates, Biden, they've known Mubarak for decades." I thought of Biden's perennial line. "All foreign policy is an extension of personal relationships." "If it had been King Abdullah," Obama said, referring to the young Jordanian monarch with whom he'd struck up a friendship, "I don't know if I could have done the same thing." As Obama delivered a statement to a smattering of press, it seemed that history might at last be breaking in a positive direction in the Middle East. His tribute to the protests was unabashed. Yet our own government was still wired to defer to the Egyptian military and ill-equipped to support a transition to democracy once the president had spoken. When the statement was over, we walked back to the Oval Office. It was a bright winter day, sun splashing on the rose garden, as we walked down the colonnade. Obama had several calls scheduled with Arab leaders, including Mohammed bin Zayed, the powerful crown prince of Abu Dhabi, who was known by his initials. "MBZ, ABZ, MBN," he said, citing a few of the Gulf Arab leaders who were similarly known by their initials and who had been lobbying on behalf of Mubarak. "Who are these guys?" Gibbs said. "I don't know," I said to Obama. "But they're not going to be paying for your presidential library." Chapter 10. Libya. One of my earliest memories of American foreign policy is of Ronald Reagan sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office and explaining, in his grandfatherly way, that we were bombing Libya. I was 8 years old. My father loved Reagan, so to me he could do no wrong. If Reagan said we had to teach Gaddafi a lesson for sponsoring terrorist attacks, then surely he was right. Gaddafi was a villain, and our president was a hero who rode horses with the Queen of England. I never imagined that Gaddafi would be at the center of events that would shape the Obama presidency and my own role in it. Early in the administration, Gaddafi seemed more of a punchline than an adversary. In 2009, at our first United Nations General Assembly, he made waves when he was accompanied by a squad of female bodyguards and gave a rambling 100-minute speech that called for an investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy. On the other hand, he had improved his international standing by giving up Libya's nuclear weapons program. Gaddafi had turned into another aging and erratic dictator with rich children who liked to hang out in London and intelligence services who fought al-Qaeda. A few days after Mubarak stepped down, the protests in neighboring Libya escalated sharply. There were new calls for Gaddafi to go. Security forces used live ammunition to fire into the crowds. Rebels seized control of parts of the country, including the second largest city, Benghazi. Instead of Egypt, it was now Libya on every television screen in the West Wing, dominating the questions at press briefings and forcing its way onto the agenda of the President of the United States. On February 22nd, we reached one of those turning points that became familiar in the Arab Spring, the moment when a dictator gives a big speech that indicates how he's going to respond to the calls for him to step down. A group of us sat in my cramped office watching the television as Gaddafi, dressed in burnt orange robes, stood in front of the remains of a building that had been bombed by Reagan, an English translation scrolling across the bottom of the screen. Defiant, he vowed to purify Libya inch by inch, house by house, home by home, street by street, person by person, until the country is clean of the dirt and impurities. For me, this was a time when every moment had the electric charge of history. I would host meetings with Libyan Americans who came to the White House to share stories of their besieged families who were fighting for their lives, showing us photographs of children half a world away, imploring us to do something, anything, to help. Journalists who moved from one protest to another called me, not to seek comment, but to share stories as they were experiencing their first glimmer of hopefulness in a war-torn Middle East and wanted to talk about it. Experts sent us papers trying to place the unfolding events in the Arab world in historical context. Was this analogous to the fall of the Berlin Wall, when the nations of Eastern Europe transitioned to democracy like flowers blooming? Or was this like Hungary in 1956, or Tiananmen Square in 1989? Popular movements that would be trampled by strongmen. I'd lie awake in bed, my mind racing. A few weeks ago, it seemed that helping to pass the new START treaty was the biggest thing I'd be a part of in government. Now, every statement we made, every meeting I was in, every decision Obama had to make, felt like the most important thing I'd ever been a part of, and I wanted us to do something, to shape events instead of observing them. We exhausted the available options within days, freezing Gaddafi's assets, putting in place travel bans for him and his family, working through the United Nations to impose an arms embargo, referring him to the International Criminal Court for potential crimes against humanity. People with ties to the Gaddafi family were sent messages that he should leave, take up residence somewhere else, let the country avoid a civil war. To no avail. On February 26th, in the most routine kind of press statement, the readout of a call between Obama and Angela Merkel, we decided to call for Gaddafi to go. The president stated that when a leader's only means of staying in power is to use mass violence against his own people, he has lost the legitimacy to rule and needs to do what is right for his country by leaving now. Gaddafi was the second Arab leader whose departure we had sought in as many months. He would not be the last. And yet, even if it felt as if things were moving at an accelerated pace, the world outside the White House pressed in upon us, insisting that we were moving too slowly, doing too little too late. In 2011, it wasn't just television images that brought the conflict home. In social media feeds, Gaddafi's crackdown was narrated in text messages and Twitter posts. Because the world could now digest the brutal advance of Gaddafi's forces in real time, whatever happened was on our watch. Members of Congress started to call for a no-fly zone over Libya so that Gaddafi's planes would be grounded. Reporters asked us how many more people had to die before Barack Obama did something. Most people in government didn't want to do anything. The military made it clear that Libya wasn't a priority. They had two wars to deal with and little desire for a third. A no-fly zone wasn't just a talking point. It was a complex undertaking that involved eliminating all of Gaddafi's air defenses and patrolling the skies over Libya indefinitely. Others in the White House wondered why, with the economy foremost on the minds of Americans, the Arab Spring consumed so much of Obama's time. No one had voted for Obama so that he'd do something about Libya. When the U.S. government wants to avoid doing something, it avoids producing the options to do something. And so, as the days went by, no option for a no-fly zone made its way to Obama, even though it was being debated across Washington and other capitals around the world. Arab leaders told Hillary Clinton that they were prepared to be part of an effort to punish Gaddafi. In Europe, the spotlight-loving French president Nicolas Sarkozy signaled that he was going to push for a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a no-fly zone. Soon, we would have to take a position one way or another, so Obama convened a meeting of his National Security Council on March 15th to decide where we would stand at the UN. The meeting was in the Situation Room and started with an assessment of the situation in Libya. Each of us had a map in front of us that showed Gaddafi's methodical progress in taking back pieces of the country. His army had reached a place called Ajdabiya, a town of about 80,000 people in the middle of the desert. Ajdabiya, the briefers explained, was the last stop on the way to Benghazi, a city of more than 600,000 and the center of anti-Gaddafi resistance for decades. From Ajdabiya, Gaddafi's forces could effectively cut off access to power and water for the people of Benghazi. This was the type of siege that foreshadows a massacre. Samantha, who lived with the permanent tagline Samantha Power, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, passed me a note saying that this was going to be the first mass atrocity that took place on our watch. I looked at the names of towns and cities written on the map in front of me, most of which I was unfamiliar with just a few weeks ago. And here we were, debating whether the people in those places would live or die. I looked at Obama, leaning back in his chair and holding the piece of paper, eyeing the same map, the same places. Clinton had dialed in by phone from Paris. It was late there, and she sounded tired. She had been on a long trip throughout the Middle East and Europe, and, she said, the leaders there were ready to pledge diplomatic and military support for a no-fly zone, and she supported it. Obama went around the table to get everyone's views. Biden said that intervention was, essentially, madness. Why should we get involved in another war in a Muslim-majority country? Gates and Mullen also argued against doing anything. The military already had its hands full in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bill Daley, a bald, Chicago-accented centrist who'd recently been hired as chief of staff to make deals with Republicans and stabilize relations between Obama and the business community, seemed incredulous that we were debating the issue at all, given everything we had to do at home. Susan Rice argued for more assertive action. "This is like Rwanda," she said, citing a genocide that had been a stain on her own conscience. She was a mid-level staffer in the Clinton White House when hundreds of thousands of people were killed there in only a few months, many with machetes. She'd been a minor character in Samantha's book, and not one of the good guys. "We have a moral responsibility to act," she said. And then Obama diverged from his usual script. Having heard the views of his principals, the people sitting around the table, he started to call on people who occupied the seats along the walls. He wanted, I could tell, different views. One by one, the more junior staffers argued for action, highlighting the generational chasm that had opened up over the last several weeks. When it got to Samantha, she talked in humanitarian terms, pointing out that we knew what Gaddafi had done in the past when his rule was threatened. "He massacres civilians," she said. "He told us what he was going to do in Benghazi. He'd go house to house, killing people." Obama turned his chair to face me. "Ben?" I repeated some of the other arguments that had been made, the humanitarian risk, the danger of signaling that dictators could stay in power if they killed, but would fall if they didn't. As I spoke, I could sense Obama's ambivalence. I realized that my job, my responsibility for communications, offered me an argument that might resonate. The fact that we would have to stand up and explain to the world why we weren't acting in Libya if we chose not to. The international community is prepared to do this, I said. We know there's going to be a debate at the United Nations. We know there's support for action. We know the French are going to move forward. So the one thing I'd also say, I guess, is that we'd have to consider what we would say if we choose not to do something. I paused to let that scenario sink in. We'd have to explain to the American people and the world why we're choosing not to join the international community in doing something. Bob Gates and Mike Mullen sat stoically at the table, looking as if they'd rather be discussing just about anything else, noting that no other country had the capacity to establish a no-fly zone without our support, reminding us that when we'd done so in the past, over northern Iraq or the Balkans, we had to bear the burden ourselves. Obama asked what impact a no-fly zone would have on the scenario we'd heard about from the briefers, an assault on Benghazi by Gaddafi's ground forces. None, they said. Even if our planes were securing the skies above Libya, Gaddafi's troops could still advance on the ground. So we're debating an option that won't even solve this problem, Obama said. There was an edge of anger in his voice. It was quiet for a moment. What time is it? He asked, looking over at the clocks on the wall. He had a dinner scheduled that night with Gates, Mullen, and all the U.S. military combatant commanders and their wives, an annual social event at the White House. I'm going to go have dinner with the COCOMs, and I want us to get back together afterward and look at some real options. Over the next few hours, pop-up meetings were held throughout the White House, options papers written, UN Security Council resolutions drafted, military plans sent over from the Pentagon, the types of contingency plans that remain buried in the enormous bureaucracy until they're called up by the White House. And then, around 7:30, we all returned to our seats in the Situation Room, a new set of maps and papers in front of us, a stark menu of options in front of Obama. Bomb Gaddafi's forces on the ground to stop their advance on Benghazi. Put a no-fly zone in place. Or do nothing, leaving any action to others. We reconvened for a second meeting, taking the same seats we'd occupied a couple of hours ago. Obama was briefed on the new options, which included a no-fly zone and a more aggressive option to go after Gaddafi's forces on the ground. At the end of the meeting, Obama told us he'd made a decision. We wouldn't support the French resolution for a no-fly zone. Instead, Susan would put forward a U.S. resolution that went beyond a no-fly zone, calling for all necessary measures to protect civilians on the ground, a euphemism for war. To put the military at ease, he'd call Cameron and Sarkozy himself and make clear to them that we'd lead the effort to take out Gaddafi's air defenses and ground forces at the beginning of the operation, but we'd expect the Europeans to move into the lead after a period of days. He turned to me. Days, not weeks, he said. That would be our public posture. With that, things were set in motion. Within 2 days, after frantic work by Susan, a resolution passed the UN Security Council authorizing the use of force to protect civilians in Libya. Military plans accelerated, and Obama secured commitments from the French and British. At the same time, a defiant letter from Gaddafi to Obama reached the White House. "We in Libya are confronting the terrorists of Al-Qaeda," it read. "In Libya, there are no political and administrative demands, nor are there any disputes. If you decide that terrorism need not be fought, then let's negotiate with bin Laden." This was not a man who was going to meet our demands. Brasilia was an unlikely place to start a war. A planned capital city, built for government business, dotted with 1960s and 70s style concrete office buildings. It could not have been farther from the Middle East. While Obama met with Dilma Rousseff, the former Marxist guerrilla and political prisoner who had become president, I worked in a staff office at the Palácio do Planalto, the Brazilian equivalent of the White House. Our expectation was that military operations would start in Libya the next day. But at the same time that Obama was holding his meeting, Sarkozy was hosting a conference on Libya in Paris. With Gaddafi still advancing on Benghazi, Clinton reported that Sarkozy was pressing for military operations to begin that day. This could only work if the United States began taking out Gaddafi's air defenses immediately. While Obama wrapped up his meeting, we started to assemble his top national security team for a conference call. After some tense moments when the call kept dropping, Obama was patched through and I watched him listen intently. The military was ready to go now, they just needed his order. "You have my authorization," he said with formality. Brazil prides itself on not interfering in the affairs of other countries and not going to war. Its president was a woman of the left, persecuted by Brazil's former military government because of her politics. This was probably the first war ever launched from the offices of the Brazilian president, and it was being done by a foreigner. We moved on to a luncheon for prominent Americans and Brazilians that was being hosted at the foreign ministry. I sat nervously eyeing my BlackBerry for news reports while the man next to me, a Brazilian businessman, quizzed me on the positions that Obama had taken on ethanol subsidies during the 2008 campaign. The whole scene spoke to an absurdity in the office of the American presidency. Obama sat at the head table, carrying out his duties promoting American business in a country of more than 200 million people, while the vast machinery of the U.S. government, on Obama's order, was preparing to rain down bombs on a country of 7 million. The next event was a CEO forum at a convention center. Obama would have to say something public about the war he'd just started. Otherwise, the first picture taken of him after giving this authorization would be sitting at a conference room table flanked by a bunch of CEOs. Everywhere a U.S. president goes, a venue is identified where he can give an emergency statement to a group of assembled press from behind a lectern bearing the seal of the President of the United States. When we got to the convention center, we delayed the start of the CEO forum, and I set to work writing a statement while the advance team set up the room. "Today," I wrote, "I authorized the armed forces of the United States to begin a military action in Libya in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians. That action has now begun." I paused and looked around the room, a large empty space with a scattering of tables. Obama, Bill Daley, Tom Donilon, and a few other aides chatted on the other side of the room, giving me some space. Somewhere over Libya, American planes and missiles were making their way toward Gaddafi's forces. But there was no time to process any of it. There was a statement to finish, a day's schedule to complete. I wrote as strong a statement as I could in less than half an hour. Obama read it quickly but carefully. As with the Afghanistan speech, he dialed it down. Gone was the invocation of "never again," the reference to the Holocaust, the seminal massacre that prompted generations to consider going to war to stop human beings from killing other human beings. Even in that moment, Obama didn't want to overpromise. The next day, we were in Rio. We drove into the City of God, a sprawling favela. As the motorcade snaked through streets of patchwork housing, corrugated roofs, colorful window panes, cratered sidewalks, thousands of Afro-Brazilians straining to get a glimpse of Obama, I thought about how to measure the impact of Obama and his presidency on this anonymous multitude, how to weigh the impact he had on people like those lining our motorcade route against the practical reality of a war that we had joined on the other side of the world. I watched him kicking a soccer ball with a handful of excited kids in a community center, wondering what was churning through his mind. The rest of the trip, Obama existed within the bubble of his schedule, meetings, speeches on Latin America, state dinners, while the rest of us were on calls or in press briefings related to Libya. For the first time in my life, I was the spokesperson for a government that had just gone to war. I did press briefings on camera or on the phone pacing next to a parked motorcade. Somewhere along the way, I lost my razor, and our last night in San Salvador, Obama snapped at me. "What, you can't even bother to shave?" he said. At first, I thought that he was kidding. "I think my razor is somewhere in Brazil," I said. "Pull yourself together," he said. "We have to be professional here." There was an edge to his voice. He wasn't joking. I felt like exploding. I haven't slept more than 3 hours in days. I'm doing 3 jobs out there defending this war for hours each day. Obama seemed oblivious to the work I was doing out of his sight, work that left me no time to buy a razor. But as I calmed down, I realized that these little flashes were how he relieved some of the stress that he had to be feeling, and that being composed and professional, doing the job, was how he managed to take everything in stride. I hadn't just failed to shave. I'd deviated from his ethos of unflappability. On the flight back to Washington, I headed to the back of Air Force One to brief the journalists who were traveling with us. All of the pressure on us to act in Libya had taken a 180-degree turn the moment we did. Before, we had been getting questions about how many people had to die before we acted. Now we were getting questions about how we could avoid mission creep, whether we could transition to a European command, and whether we were at war in Libya. I had been told by our lawyers that I was not supposed to use the word war. We hadn't sought congressional authorization, and were arguing that it was a limited military operation, and therefore within the president's constitutional authority. That legalistic position, of course, was why I was being asked the question. If it's not a war, a journalist from Fox News asked, what's the right way to characterize this operation? I'd answered dozens of questions about Libya over the last few days. I was exhausted, leaning against a wall with a bunch of tape recorders in my face. I didn't have a good answer. I think, I said, that what we are doing is enforcing a resolution that has a very clear set of goals, which is protecting the Libyan people, averting a humanitarian crisis, and setting up a no-fly zone. I was giving a stock response, which felt unsatisfactory, phony, so I went a step further. Obviously, that involves kinetic military action, particularly on the front end. Kinetic military action was the type of language used in the Situation Room, a euphemism for dropping bombs and blowing things up. In this context, it sounded like a dodge, a way to call a war something other than a war. When we got back to D.C., it was apparent, in a way that you miss when you're traveling, that we were not receiving the same benefit of the doubt that had greeted Reagan's kinetic military action 25 years earlier. The Republicans who had demanded that we put a no-fly zone in place now shifted the goalposts, demanding that we do more to win in Libya. The left was nervous about another war in the Middle East. Critics on both sides were bemoaning the fact that we weren't seeking congressional authorization, even though there was no way that a Republican House would pass it if we did. In short, there was little constituency for what we were doing in Libya. This hit home for me one night when I was sitting on the couch watching Jon Stewart, the ubiquitous comic voice of authority for my demographic. He was running a series of segments on The Daily Show titled America at Not War. He started to mock my phrase, kinetic military action, while a photo of me, looking about 12 years old, flashed on the screen. My stomach started to churn, and I turned the television off. My own worldview had been shaped, in part, by reading books like Samantha's and watching liberals go on shows like Stewart's to promote movies like Hotel Rwanda. Sure, I'd said something that sounded a bit Orwellian, and I was a spokesperson for the U.S. government, whose military actions overseas prompt skepticism from large chunks of the population at home. But in my mind, I was part of a group of people acting to implement a humanitarian principle. Now it felt as if I was being punished for it, and as if I had argued for Obama to do something that his own base recoiled against. My skin would have to get thicker. Every morning, those first few days back in Washington, Obama convened a small meeting in the Situation Room to get briefed on the progress we were making in Libya, a much more hands-on approach than he ever took to daily operations in Iraq or Afghanistan. Gaddafi's air defenses were destroyed. His forces were stopped on the outskirts of Benghazi, perhaps saving tens of thousands of lives. Not a single American had been injured. After a few days of American pilots being in the lead, we transferred the operation to a NATO command, with French and British pilots taking on the bulk of the bombing. It was what Obama wanted. Multilateral, no ground forces, limited objectives. One common criticism emerged from Congress and the media. Obama had not formally addressed the nation since authorizing military action. So on March 28th, 2 weeks after the Situation Room meeting that had set everything in motion, he gave a speech at the National Defense University in Washington. The television networks said they wouldn't carry it in prime time, so it was scheduled for the second-tier window of 7:30 p.m., an apt metaphor for the Libyan operation. Cable, not network. Evening, not prime time. Kinetic military operation, not war. The speech was on a Monday, and I spent a weekend writing it. Obama was defensive. Everything had gone as planned, and yet the public and political response kept shifting, from demanding action to second-guessing it, from saying he was dithering to saying he wasn't doing enough. Even while he outlined the reasons for action in Libya, he stepped back to discuss the question that would continue to define his foreign policy, the choice of when to use military force. Unlike other wartime addresses, he went out of his way to stress the limits of what we were trying to achieve in Libya, saving lives and giving Libyans a chance to determine their future, not installing a new regime or building a democracy. He said that we would use force swiftly, decisively, and unilaterally to defend the United States, but he emphasized that when confronted with other international crises, we should proceed with caution and not act alone. I stood backstage watching the words roll on the teleprompter. In just 2 months, the world had turned upside down. We'd seen a regime fall in Tunisia, broken from a longtime U.S. ally in Egypt, and intervened in Libya. History, it seemed, was turning in the direction of young people in the streets, and we had placed the United States of America on their side. Where this drama would turn next was uncertain. Protests were already rattling a monarch in Bahrain, a corrupt leader in Yemen, a strong man in Syria. After the speech, as we began to disperse to the motorcade, I got word that Obama wanted me to ride with him back to the White House. I slid into the seat opposite him, just the two of us in the limousine as it pulled out of the loading zone and onto the darkened streets of Washington. "That turned out well," he said. "I think so," I said. "We still need to give a speech that puts all of this in context," he said, "that steps back a little bit." I was working on that a couple of weeks ago. Then Libya happened. I started to talk about how we could frame all of these different countries by talking about a set of principles that would guide the United States, the opportunity that was emerging for change. Obama's eyes drifted out the window to the passing scenery, the National Mall, monuments to leaders and wars past. "It's hard to get a grasp on what's happening," he said. "It's playing out pretty fast," I said. "We could spend all of our time on it," he said. He'd spent a lot of time recently on foreign policy. There was still an unsettled economy, a looming debate with Republicans over raising the debt ceiling, a re-election campaign that was just gathering steam. "I just wish I had some more bandwidth," he said as the limousine turned into the south driveway of the White House. I had never heard the phrase "lead from behind" until it appeared in a New Yorker article about Obama's foreign policy in April 2011. The article was typical of a Washington genre, the step-back review of a particular policy, in this case foreign policy, in which a writer interviews a mix of administration officials and outside critics to make sense of things. Most of these pieces disappear without much notice, adding to an accumulating conventional wisdom. But on occasion, a particular turn of phrase can become a bumper sticker that is affixed to a presidency. I knew we might be faced with that scenario when I sat in my office late one afternoon reading this long New Yorker piece by Ryan Lizza and reached the end. Obama may be moving towards something resembling a doctrine. One of his advisors described the president's actions as leading from behind. I had no idea who the unnamed advisor was, but a lot of people thought it was me, One of the hazards of my job was that many people assumed that just about every quote attributed to an unnamed advisor on foreign policy was me. We were constantly asked about what the Obama Doctrine was, and we usually rejected the question. The world was too complicated to sum up in a doctrine, and the only recent effort that a president made to declare a doctrine was George W. Bush's regrettable assertion that we'd preemptively go to war to prevent countries from acquiring weapons of mass destruction. We were going to be damned if we did declare a doctrine, and damned if we didn't. Looking at the risks of overpromising or oversimplifying, we decided to avoid the question. Predictably, there was an explosion of criticism on the right, which branded leading from behind as the Obama Doctrine, and used it to cast him as weak, indecisive, and un-American. The more mainstream response concerned why Obama had chosen leading from behind as a doctrine, even though he hadn't. It was all nonsense. Obama had never uttered the phrase, and he wouldn't have used it to describe his own foreign policy. It was a show, designed to distill complicated international issues into a debate that could take place on cable news. At the same time, the real estate developer and reality television show celebrity Donald Trump began flirting publicly with his own presidential run. Like anyone who grew up in 1980s New York City, I knew Trump as a tabloid punchline, more famous for his mistresses than his politics. But instead of protests in Arab cities, it was now Trump's face popping up on the television screens throughout the West Wing, the cable news networks shadowing his every move. The thing that drew the most attention was his nakedly racist demand for Obama to release his birth certificate, a subject of derision at first within the White House, but as the days went on and the attention stayed on Trump, that derision turned to anger over the outright racism of the attack and the ceaseless, credulous attention it was getting. Obama was more annoyed at the media than anything else. "I can't believe they're giving this airtime," he said. Personally, I recoiled at another part of Trump's interviews and stock speech. Time and again, he talked about all the Americans getting killed in Libya, and the assertion would go unchallenged. I'd call reporters to demand a fact check. No Americans were getting killed in Libya, and Americans watching at home shouldn't be misled to believe that they were. In response, they'd deflect any responsibility to fact check everything Trump said. After all, who would take him seriously? I took all of the criticism of Obama too personally because I felt helpless in the face of what seemed to be the insanity of it all. No Americans are being killed in Libya. Barack Obama never said leading from behind. More profoundly, I thought a bar was being set that we could never clear. The same people who had been demanding a no-fly zone were now attacking Obama for being weak on Libya. Donald Trump was simultaneously criticizing Obama for not taking Libya's oil and for getting Americans killed. The Arab Spring was upending a rotted, corrupt, authoritarian order in the Middle East, and yet the debate about these seismic events in Washington was an extension of our own partisan, diminished discourse. Chapter 11. Bin Laden. Life Inside a Secret. One April morning, I noticed multiple missed calls from the blocked number that normally signaled that it was the Situation Room calling. When I called back, I was told to come to work immediately. John Brennan and Dennis McDonough wanted to see me. When I got to Brennan's office, they asked me to close the door, which was unusual. Brennan's office was across the hall from me at the back of a suite of rooms designed to house classified information. It was a somewhat unpleasant place, with a mini-fridge, a single-cup coffee maker, a dropped ceiling, piles of intelligence reports, multiple computer screens at different levels of classification, different colored phones, and shelves half-filled with books, most of which appeared to be unread gifts. During one semi-renovation, they found dead rats in the walls. Yet in the global war against Al-Qaeda, the mix of surveillance, drone strikes, and special operations that take place in some of the most remote parts of the world, Brennan's office was the nerve center. Any decision that Obama had to make about whether to launch an operation to kill or capture someone came through here. This is very sensitive, Brennan said, folding his hands in front of him. We may have a lead on bin Laden. They described a scenario that seemed implausible no matter how much I wanted it to be true. Working through our knowledge of a network of couriers associated with bin Laden, we'd identified a compound in Abbottabad, deep inside Pakistan and close to a Pakistani military academy. We weren't certain that bin Laden was there, but it was the best lead we'd had since he'd slipped across the Afghan border in December 2001. Obama had been meeting for some weeks with a tight-knit circle of advisors, and he was nearing a decision about whether to target the compound, through a special forces raid or some kind of strike. I was now going to be brought into that circle, because someone needed to plan for how any action would be explained to the wider world if Obama decided to move forward. With this, my entire life narrowed to this one thing, this secret, which I could not talk about with anyone else. I had noticed for the past few weeks that there were occasionally meetings in the Situation Room that were not announced. The assistants of senior national security officials had camera feeds on their computers that could show you what was happening in each of the three conference rooms. For some meetings, those cameras were turned off. I'd felt a little miffed at being excluded from whatever was going on, though I knew better than to ask about it. Now I was being initiated into this secret society. I started to attend endless daily meetings, co-chaired by Brennan and McDonough, at which every aspect of this matter was discussed. They'd start with a review of the intelligence case, usually presented by Michael Morell, the deputy director of the CIA. Morell spoke with frightening precision, numbering his points, leaning forward a bit as he spoke, as if bringing you into a conspiracy, and then sitting back in his chair, hands folded, when he was finished. The points were often the same. The nature of the compound, larger and more secluded than other homes in the area, and surrounded by a high wall. The number of people in the compound, their suspected ages and genders, and how they matched up with those of bin Laden's family. Their pattern of life, the fact that they almost never came and went, wore Pashtun clothing, and burned their trash. The presence of a tall man who paced occasionally in the courtyard. The Pacer, they called him. A team of operatives was being deployed to Afghanistan in the event that a mission to capture or kill the Pacer was set in motion. Another option was to just take out the compound with a precision strike. Beyond that were many questions. Who would call the Pakistanis and when? Who would call the Saudis and when? What happens if we capture him alive? If he's dead, how can we verify that it's bin Laden? How should he be buried? What happens if it's not him? What happens if it all goes wrong? Late on a Thursday afternoon, Obama chaired a meeting that would be his final one before making a decision. The timing was being driven by an almost impossibly cinematic concern. The absence of moonlight over Abbottabad that weekend offered the best window to launch an operation. The meeting kicked off with a briefing on the latest intelligence, and Obama asked questions which suggested that he had spent many hours thinking about it. He knew how tall the people were who lived in this compound, how many families lived there, that they burned their trash. I watched Obama digest this information, wondering how much he'd been turning it over in his head while I'd been with him in other meetings over the last few weeks. Along with me, there were a few other newcomers, including a red team of intelligence analysts who had been brought on to review the case that it was bin Laden at the compound. They had a lower degree of confidence, 40 to 60%, they said. The conversation went down a rabbit hole, people debating percentages, until Obama lost patience with the exercise. That's enough, he said. Ultimately, this is a 50-50 call. The conversation then turned to the ways that we could get this Pacer. Admiral Bill McCraven was overseeing the special operations team that had deployed to Afghanistan. He spoke with confidence, conveying a sense that this is the type of thing that he and his men did for a living, but that they were also taking extra care in preparing for this circumstance. "I'm confident we can get in and out," he said. There was another option, to simply take out the compound, but Obama seemed less interested in that, as it would deny us the certainty that the Pacer was indeed bin Laden, and whatever intelligence could be gathered from the compound. Obama moved methodically around the table, asking for people's recommendations. For the first time, Gates was in a different place from the uniformed military. He was firmly against a raid. "Too risky," he said. He referenced Desert One, Jimmy Carter's botched effort to rescue the Americans who had been taken hostage by Iran. Like that operation, this one would involve covertly sending American helicopters deep inside another country. Desert One had resulted in 8 dead Americans, a humiliated United States, and a stinging electoral defeat for a first-term Democratic president. I was deflated that Gates spoke the words out loud. Mullen and McRaven, on the other hand, were strongly supportive. So were Brennan and Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA. Biden was opposed, and he went on at length about the catastrophe that could ensue with Pakistan, a firefight at the scene, threats to our embassy, a break in our relations. Clinton described it, repeatedly, as a 51-49 call. Ultimately, though, it was too risky not to go. What if people learned that we had the chance and we failed to act? To her, the risk of not going outweighed the risk of going. She voted yes. It was obvious to me that Obama was going to do this. He had a way of looking straight ahead when he was listening at the same time that his mind was elsewhere. I could tell that he had turned the intelligence over and over in his mind. This is a 50-50 call. That he understood the risks with Pakistan. When he asked me what I thought, I simply said, "You always said you were going to do this." Because I'd lived through the debate on the campaign, I knew he had meant what he said about going into Pakistan. He asked me to prepare for 4 scenarios. 1, bin Laden is at the compound and it's a success. 2, bin Laden is at the compound and it's messy, people killed, Pakistani security services, instability. 3, bin Laden's not there, but we get in and out cleanly. 4, bin Laden's not there, and it's a mess. At the end of the meeting, Obama didn't tip his hand. He just said he'd make his decision overnight. As people filed out of the room, Biden pulled Dennis and me into a smaller, adjacent room and closed the door. He looked genuinely pained. "You fellas really think he should do this?" "I do," Dennis said. I agreed and repeated my point about Obama's always having said he would go into Pakistan to get bin Laden. "Well," Biden said, "I'm just trying to give him a little space." I believed that. Biden sometimes took strident positions in meetings to widen the spectrum of views and options available to Obama. He also worked hard to understand Obama's mind. "You've always got his back," McDonough said. "You better believe it," Biden replied. "But we're also going to need to say some prayers." I started to prepare all the materials we'd need. I had no one else to work with in the White House, so I sat alone at my classified computer, putting together the playbook for each scenario. I edited declassified points that had been prepared by the CIA, laying out the intelligence basis for action. Particularly if bin Laden wasn't there, we'd have to explain why we thought it might have been him. I compiled all of bin Laden's declarations of war on the United States and his celebrations of the 9/11 attacks. I pulled together statements by Bush and Obama pledging to get bin Laden. Sitting there alone, late into the night, I felt I was revisiting the events that had led me down to Washington and into the Obama campaign, events that had been eclipsed, in some ways, by the turmoil of the Iraq War and the tumult of the Arab Spring. This, I thought, is what we were supposed to do after 9/11. I opened a new document, titled it Remarks of President Barack Obama, and began drafting the speeches he might give along with the different scenarios. But the words didn't come. The negative scenarios were too nightmarish to contemplate, let alone put into words, and the positive scenario seemed as if it should not be jinxed by this kind of preparatory work. I knew that I wouldn't have a lot of time to write something if the operation went forward, but I left undisturbed the history that had yet to happen. The next morning, a Friday, Obama relayed his decision to move forward.